Ethernet says, the value of a network grows proportional to the square of the number of its users. In the case of the Internet, every new computer, every new server, and every new user added expands the possibilities for everyone else who's already there. The same principle holds true in growing your web of relationships. The bigger it gets, the more attractive it becomes, and the faster it grows. That's why I say that a network is like a muscle. The more you work it, the bigger it gets. Such cloning is also a good way to ensure that a meeting or get-together is worthwhile. If I'm meeting someone whom I don't know that well, I might invite someone I do know just to make sure the meeting does not become a waste of time. My mentees, for instance, get a special kick out of sitting in on such meetings, and it can be a great learning opportunity. It gets them FaceTime with me. They get a chance to see business in action, and I make sure our reason for the meeting gets accomplished. In most cases, the mentees end up contributing something to the meeting as well. Don't underestimate young people's ability to find creative new insight. When you try this sort of thing, pay special attention to the chemistry between people. Do you have a sense of who will get along well with each other? It doesn't mean that everyone has to have the same background and sensibility. In fact, a nice mix of different professions and personalities can be the perfect recipe for a terrific gathering. Trust your instincts. One litmus test I often use is to ask myself if I think I'll have fun. If the answer is yes, that is usually a good sign that the dynamic will work. Have you taken a colleague to lunch lately? Why not invite him or her out today? And include a few other people from different parts of your company or business network. One of the most frequent questions I've gotten over the years is how to stay visible when your business dealings are mostly virtual. Whether you're in Kansas or Kuala Lumpur, satellite workers need to take some extra care to keep up their contacts. Social media is your friend, to be sure, but it's not the same as sitting with people, talking, and catching up. The more bloated our virtual communications become, the more that people are going to use in-person contact as a filter for true relevance. I highly recommend you budget some time and money for conferences and to visit cities where you can schedule a few days or even just an overnight during which you host a cocktail party or schedule a bunch of meetings. That said, technology has come a long way. Group meetings and one-on-ones using a tool like Google Hangouts, WebEx, or Skype can make you feel almost like you're in a room together once you get comfortable using them. Host a virtual happy hour once a month and organize it around a discussion topic. Or set up a weekly accountability group of 3 to 4 people who set goals together and share quick personal and professional updates. Have everyone commit to 3 months and then rebuild the group as people come and go each quarter. Once a month, ask group members to bring a friend to introduce to the group. Soon you'll have an ever-expanding web of friends and contacts. Learn from your setbacks. For all his legendary success and greatness as a president, Abraham Lincoln lost all the time. Lincoln experienced numerous business, political, and personal setbacks over his life. But he never let any of his failures discourage him from pursuing his goals. Lincoln failed in business. He failed as a farmer. He lost running for state legislature. He had a nervous breakdown. He was rejected for a job as a land officer. When he was finally elected to the legislature, he lost the vote to be speaker. He ran for Congress and lost. he ran for and lost a U.S. Senate seat. He ran for vice president and lost. He ran for the Senate and lost again. And when he was finally elected president, the nation he was elected to lead broke apart. But by this time, all the activities, experiences, and people he came to know in the process helped him set a direction for that country that will stand as one of America's great legacies. My point is, behind any successful person stands a long string of failures. But toughness and tenacity like Lincoln's can overcome these setbacks. Lincoln knew the only way to gain ground, to move forward, to turn his goals into reality, was to learn from his setbacks, to stay engaged, and to press on. Chapter 12. Share Your Passions. I have a confession to make. I've never been to a so-called networking event in my life. If properly organized, these get-togethers, in theory, could work. Most, however, are for the desperate and uninformed. The average attendees are often unemployed and too quick to pass on their resumes to anyone with a free hand, usually the hand of someone else who is unemployed, looking to pass on his resume. Imagine a congregation of people with nothing in common except joblessness. That's not exactly a recipe for facilitating close bonds. When it comes to meeting people, it's not only whom you get to know, but also how and where you get to know them. For example, take the first class section on an airplane. Flying first class is not something most people can afford. But there's an interesting camaraderie among those front seats that you won't find back in coach. To begin with, there are always a number of movers and shakers up front in close quarters for hours at a time. Because they've slapped down an absurd premium for the luxury of getting off the plane a few seconds earlier than the rest of the passengers, fellow first-classers assume you, too, are important, and they often seek to quench their curiosity about who you are and why you're as dumb as they are to pay such an inflated price. I can't tell you how many valuable clients and contacts I've met during a conversation struck up during an in-flight meal. By the way, this is the only acceptable time to bother your seatmate. At a so-called networking event, the dynamics are just the opposite. People assume you're in the same boat they are, desperate. Credibility is hard to gain. If you're jobless, doesn't it make sense to hang out with the job givers rather than fellow job seekers? There are better ways and better places to spend your time. Shared interests are the basic building blocks of any relationship. Race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity, or business, professional, and personal interests are relational glue. It makes sense, then, that events and activities where you'll thrive are those built around interests you're most passionate about. Friendship is created out of the quality of time spent between two people, not the quantity. There is a misconception that to build a bond, two people need to spend a great deal of time together. This is not the case. Outside your family and work, you probably can count the people you see a great deal of in the course of a month on two hands. Yet surely you have more than 10 friends. It is what you do together that matters, not how often you meet. That's why you have to pay special attention to where you're most comfortable and what activities you most enjoy. Usually it's the events and activities you excel at that you're most passionate about. So it makes sense to make these the focus of your efforts. For me, my love of food and exercise has led to the most amazing get-togethers.
For others, it may be stamps, baseball cards, politics, or skydiving that brings you together.
In more recent years, I've been most passionate about giving back, and can tell you that relationships forged while in service to others are truly something special. I now plan an annual trip where my family goes with friends, colleagues, and clients to Antigua, Guatemala, where we work with several adopted villages. Before, during, and afterward, we share stories and photos on my website and in social media and ask for donations. So it's not just us who are swept up in the experience. I truly believe the measure of the impact of these trips isn't only in the kids' lives that we improve, although that alone would be enough. It's also in the difference we make by coming home better leaders, colleagues, and parents, and the heightened productivity and satisfaction that continues throughout the year. The power of shared passion in bringing people together can best be seen today in the explosion of crowdfunding campaigns and the platforms that make them possible. Take Kickstarter, the most well-known site. Kickstarter focuses on launching specific projects, not general fundraising. In its first 4 years in business, 3.7 million people together raised more than $545 million for projects that they believed deserved a shot. With word of mouth spread mostly through social media, enthusiasts threw dollars at everything from DIY 3D printers to punk music albums. When we are truly passionate about something, it's contagious. Our passion draws other people to who we are and what we care about. Others respond by letting their guard down, which is why sharing your passion is important in business. I can tell more about how someone is likely to react in a business situation from my experience with them at an intimate dinner, or after just one strenuous workout, than I can from any number of in-office meetings. We just naturally loosen up outside the office. Or perhaps it's the venue itself, not to mention the wine over dinner. It's astonishing how much more you can learn about someone when you are both doing something you enjoy. I have a friend who is the executive vice president of a large bank in Charlotte. His networking hotspot is, of all places, the YMCA. He tells me that at 5 or 6 in the morning, the place is buzzing with exercise fanatics like himself, getting in a workout before they go to the office. He scouts the place for entrepreneurs, current customers, and prospects. Then, as he's huffing and puffing on the Stairmaster, he answers their questions about investments and loans. Besides food and exercise, I sometimes take people to church. That's right, church. I attend a mostly African-American and Hispanic Catholic church in Los Angeles, St. Agatha's. It's wonderfully unorthodox. Instead of passing the peace in the form of a simple handshake, a gospel choir belts out uplifting tunes while the congregants walk around the church hugging each other for 10 minutes. It's an amazing scene. I don't try to foist my beliefs on anyone. The people I bring along, whether an actor or lawyer or an atheist or Orthodox Jew, tend to see my invitation as a kind of personalized gift. It shows them that I think so highly of them that I'm willing to share such a deeply personal part of my life. Contrary to popular business wisdom, I don't believe there has to be a rigid line between our private and public lives. Old-school business views the expression of emotions and compassion as vulnerability. Today's new business people see such attributes as the glue that binds us. When our relationships are stronger, our businesses and careers
are more successful. Take Bonnie DeGreese, a consultant who used to work at the Gartner Group. Bonnie sends her list of contacts and associates an annual newsletter that is, well, all about her. She writes of the new and exciting things she's working on, or about her family. She wrote about how the death of her father changed her life. You might think those who received this letter were uncomfortable with such a public display of emotion. Just the opposite. More and more people, men, women, colleagues, and strangers alike, asked to receive Bonnie's letter. They'd write her back and tell her of similar experiences they'd been through. After a few years, Bonnie had a network that stretched across the nation. She's poured her heart and passion onto the page, and because of it, she's received the trust and admiration of hundreds in return. Make a list of the things you're passionate about. Use your passions as a guide to which activities and events you should be seeking out. Use them to engage new and old contacts. If you love baseball, for example, take potential and current clients to a ball game, or invite them to join you in a fantasy league. It doesn't matter what you do, only that it's something you love doing. Your passions and the events you build around them will create deeper levels of intimacy. Pay attention to matching the event to the particular relationship you're trying to build. I've got an informal list of activities I use to keep in touch with my business and personal friends. Here are some things I like to do. 1. 15 minutes and a cup of coffee. It's quick, it's out of the office, and it's a great way to meet someone new. This proved one of my most popular recommendations from the first edition of this book. I know because I started getting dozens of requests a week for these meetings. So remember my earlier advice. Make sure you lay out very clearly why those 15 minutes will be valuable to them. 2. Conferences. If I'm attending a conference in, say, Seattle, I'll pull out a list of people in the area I know or would like to know better and see if they might like to drop in for a particularly interesting keynote speech or dinner. 3. Invite someone to share a workout or a hobby. Golf, chess, stamp collecting, a book club, etc. 4. A quick early breakfast, lunch, drinks after work, or dinner together. There's nothing like food to break the ice. 5. Invite someone to a special event. For me, a special event, such as an evening at the theater, a book signing party, or a concert, is made even more special if I bring along a few people who I think might particularly enjoy the occasion. 6. Entertaining at home. I view dinner parties at home as sacred. I like to make these events as intimate as possible. To ensure they stay that way, I generally will invite only one or two people I don't know that well. By dinner's end, I want those people leaving my home feeling as if they've made a whole new set of friends. And that's hard to do if it's a dinner filled with strangers. 7. Volunteering. Work with an organization to create a day of service that can involve 5 to 10 volunteers. Or pull together a team to join a charity walk. Or for something more informal, pull a group together to pack lunches and distribute them in an area where you know you'll find many people in need. Of course, we all need to schedule the appropriate time with friends and family as well, or just to read or relax. While enriching your life to include others whenever and wherever you can, make sure you're not neglecting the key relationships in your life. When your day is fueled by passion, filled with interesting people to share it with, Reaching out will seem less like a challenge or a chore and more like an effortless consequence of the way you work. Chapter 13. Follow up or fail. How often do you find yourself standing face to face with someone you've met before, but you can't recall their name? We live in a fast-paced digital world that bombards us with information. Our inboxes are a constant procession of new and old names demanding our attention. Our brains are in constant overdrive, trying to keep track of all the bits and bytes and names that cross our desk each and every day. It's natural that to stay sane, we must forget or ignore most of the data clamoring for a sliver of real estate in our already overcrowded noggins. In such a world, it's incomprehensible that only a small percentage of us decide to follow up once we've met someone new. I can't say this strongly enough. When you meet someone with whom you want to establish a relationship, take the extra little step to ensure you won't be lost in their mental attic. Just recently, I was down in Florida giving a speech at an award ceremony for past and present members of my college fraternity, Sigma Chi. I probably gave my card and email address out to at least 100 people that night. After the black tie affair had ended, I retreated to my hotel in the wee hours of the morning and checked my email. There in my inbox was a simple, gracious note from a young fraternity brother expressing his thanks for the speech, what it meant to him as someone who came from a similar background, and his hopes that someday he and I might sit down for a cup of coffee. Within the next 2 weeks, well over 100 people emailed or called to express similar sentiments. The follow-up I remember best is the one I got first. The most memorable gifts I have ever received are those whose value could not be measured in terms of dollars and cents. They are the heartfelt letters, emails, and cards I receive from people thanking me for guidance and advice. Do you want to stand out from the crowd? Then you'll be miles ahead by following up better and smarter than the horde scrambling for the person's attention. The fact is, most people don't follow up very well, if at all. Good follow-up alone elevates you above 95% of your peers. The follow-up is the hammer and nails of your networking toolkit. In fact, follow-up is the key to success in any field. Making sure a new acquaintance retains your name and the favorable impression you've created is a process you should set in motion right after you've met someone. Give yourself between 12 and 24 hours after you meet someone to follow up. If you meet somebody on a plane, send them an email later that day. If you meet somebody over cocktails, again, send them an email the next morning. For random encounters and chance meetings, email is a fine tool for dropping a quick note to say, "It was a pleasure meeting you. We must keep in touch." In such an email, I like to cite something particular we talked about in the course of our conversation, whether a shared hobby or business interest, that serves as a mental reminder of who I am. You might follow the email up with a LinkedIn request if you see they use the site. Depending on the circumstances and how well we clicked, I might send a Facebook request as well. There are some people who are cagey about using Facebook for work contacts, so I'm always careful to give them an easy out. If you use Facebook for new friends, I'd love to connect here. If not, no worries. I'll be in touch. When I leave the meeting, I put the name and email address of the new acquaintance in my contact list and program my calendar to remind me in a month's time to drop the person another email, just to keep in touch. Why go to all the trouble of meeting new people if you're not going to work on making them a part of your life? In the aftermath of a business meeting, I've taken to doing something my classmate at HBS and former COO James Clark swears by. In his follow-up, he always reiterates the commitments everyone has made and asks when a second follow-up meeting can be arranged. When the other person has agreed to do something, whether it's meeting for coffee next time you're in town or signing a major deal, try to get it in writing. It shouldn't be formulaic or ironclad, just something such as, "It was great talking to you over lunch yesterday. I wanted to follow up with some thoughts we discussed yesterday. I believe Farazi Greenlight can serve the interests of your company, and I've had time to work out the finer details. The next time I'm in town, I'd love to get on your calendar and chat for 5 or 10 minutes." 9 times out of 10, the person will casually write back accepting your offer to meet again. Then, when the time comes to take that person up on his offer to talk again, you can call him with the force of his email commitment in writing behind you. He's already agreed to meet. Now the question is when, and your persistence will assure that happens at some point. But remember, and this is critical, don't remind them of what they can do for you. Instead, focus on what you might be able to do for them. It's about giving them a reason to want to follow up. Another effective way to follow up is to forward relevant articles to the people in your network who might be interested. When people do this for me, I'm tremendously appreciative. It shows they're thinking about me and the issues I'm facing. While email is one perfectly acceptable way to follow up, there are other methods to consider. A handwritten thank you note these days can particularly capture a person's attention. When's the last time you received a handwritten letter? When you get something addressed to you personally, you open it. The thank you note is an opportunity to reinforce a perception of continuity in a relationship and create an aura of goodwill. Mention any pertinent information you failed to bring up in your meeting. Emphasize both your desire to meet again and your offer to help. Here are a few more reminders of what to include in your follow-ups. Always express your gratitude. Be sure to include an item of interest from your meeting or conversation, a joke or a shared moment of humor. Reaffirm whatever commitments you both made, going both ways. Be brief and to the point. Always address the thank you note to the person by name. After emailing, send requests to connect through social media. Timeliness is key. Send them as soon as possible after the meeting or interview. Many people wait until the holidays to say thank you or reach out. Why wait? Your follow-ups will be timelier, more appropriate, and certainly better remembered. Don't forget to follow up with those who have acted as the go-between for you and someone else. Let the original referrer know how the conversation went, and express your appreciation for their help. Make follow-up a habit. Make it automatic. When you do, the days of struggling to remember people's names and of other people struggling to remember yours will be a thing of the past. Chapter 14. Be a conference commando. Military strategists know that most battles are won before the first shot is fired. The side that determines where, when, and how an engagement is fought usually gains an insurmountable advantage. And so it is with most successful conferences. Turning a conference into your own turf and setting goals ahead of time is what shifts a casual conference attendance into a mission. Don't just be an attendee. Be a conference commando. Conferences are good for mainly one thing. No, it's not the coffee and cookies it breaks. It's not even pricey business enlightenment. They provide a forum to meet the kind of like-minded people who can help you fulfill your mission and goals. Before deciding to attend a conference, I sometimes informally go so far as using a simple return on investment type thought process. Is the likely return I'll get from the relationships I establish and build equal to or greater than the price of the conference and the time I spend there? If so, I attend. If not, I don't. It's that simple. That may seem like an awfully pragmatic view of conferences, but it works. Right after we sold Yaya, the new owners instituted a set of cost-cutting policies relative to travel and conferences. I thought the policies were fundamentally off the mark. The owners saw conferences as boondoggles, pleasant affairs for indulgent executives, rather than as revenue generators. To our new parent company, the costs of sending people to a few events each year seemed like an unnecessary expense for a startup company. I strongly disagreed and promised to convince them otherwise. I set about recording the actual number of revenue-generating projects that came directly from people I had met at conferences. The owners were stunned when I presented them a spreadsheet showing successive deals and how a significant chunk of revenue could be traced back to one conference or another. Their ill-tempered disposition toward these business get-togethers, and these executives are far from alone in holding such attitudes, stems from an all-too-common misperception that conferences are places to find insight. Wrong. Real, actionable insight mostly comes from experience, books, and other people. Roundtable discussions and keynote speeches can be fun, even inspirational, but rarely is there the time to impart true knowledge. But there may be no better place to extend your professional network and, on occasion, get deals done. Let me give you an example based on sales. In the old model of selling, 80% of a salesperson's time went into setting up meetings, giving a presentation, and trying to close a deal. The other 20% was spent developing a relationship with the customer. Today we focus mostly on relationship selling. Smart salespeople, in fact smart employees and business owners of all stripes, spend 80% of their time building strong relationships with the people they do business with. The slickest PowerPoint presentation can't compete with the development of real affection and trust in capturing the hearts and minds of other people. Those who use conferences properly have a huge leg up at your average industry gathering, while others quietly sit taking notes, content to sip their free bottled water. These men and women are setting up one-on-one meetings, organizing dinners, and in general, making each conference an opportunity to meet people who could change their lives. If these people seem as if they aren't playing by the same rules as their fellow attendees, you're right. They've gone well beyond the traditional warmed-over advice to wear your badge, warmly greet everyone, establish firm eye contact, and other common refrains that fail to distinguish them from the rest of the horde. Yes, there's a guide to getting the most out of a conference. My friend Paul Reddy, a software executive, claims people are either bowling balls or pins at the conference. If you're the ball, you walk or roll into a conference, event, or an organization, and you blow it apart. With a dash of bravado and ingenuity, you leave a positive impression in your wake, create friendships, and achieve the goals on your agenda. The pins sit placidly by, waiting for something, anything, to happen to them. Don't think of your next conference as a business-related retreat. Think of it as a well-coordinated campaign to further your mission. Here are the rules I follow at each and every event I attend. Help the organizer. Better yet, be the organizer. Conferences are logistical nightmares. There are 1,000 different things that go into pulling off a successful business gathering. The mess that can ensue is an opportunity for you to come in and help out and become an insider in the process. Once you're on the inside, you can find out who will be attending and what the hot events will be. And you'll find yourself at all those unlisted dinners and cocktail parties that are thrown for the conference poobahs. How do you find yourself part of the process? It's not really all that hard. First, review the event's materials. Visit its website. And find out who the main contact is for putting together the conference. Put in a phone call. The person responsible for these kinds of events is generally overworked and stressed out. I like to call these people a few months ahead of the event and say, I'm really looking forward to the conference you're putting together. I'm interested in helping make this year be the best year ever, and I'm willing to devote a chunk of my resources, be it time, creativity, or connections, to make this year's event a smash hit. How can I help? I guarantee the coordinator will be shocked with delight. I say that because I was once responsible for those stressed-out planners back in my early days as CMO of Deloitte. Deloitte Consulting was working with Michael Hammer to grow a credible re-engineering practice. We thought a conference might be a great way to introduce our relationship with Michael to the market, strengthen our brand, and win a few customers to boot. So we proposed a joint conference hosted by Deloitte and Michael Hammer. We would bring the industry expertise and case studies, and Michael would bring his expertise in re-engineering and his understanding of how to run a world-class conference. It gave me a chance to see the inner workings of how a successful conference is orchestrated and, of course, build a great relationship with Mike. I became acutely aware of how powerful it was to know in advance who would be attending, why some speakers were chosen and some were not, and what the best forums were for networking. From the outset, our idea was to apply some method to the usual conference madness. A tracking system was put in place that recorded daily our progress against the objectives we set for ourselves. Each Deloitte partner's objective was to meet 2 people who were assigned to them from the guests we knew would be coming. Each was given 1 person as a primary target. Someone we really wanted to win as a client. The other person was someone we thought Deloitte would benefit from knowing, perhaps a member of the media. The basic goal remained, quite simply, to meet new people. Because we knew who was attending beforehand, the partners got a 1-page bio of the people assigned them, listing who they were, what they did, their accomplishments and hobbies, and the potential challenges their company faced that Deloitte might be able to address. This was enough information to make a real connection when the partner finally met the individual. We also gave the partners a list of ideas of how to actually catch up with their targets and what to say when they met them. At the end of each day, the partners would report whom they met, where, and how the encounter went. If someone had a difficult time meeting their target person, we strategized for the next day, making sure that the partner and the individual they were assigned to would sit at the same dinner table the following evening. Or I'd make a point of making the introduction myself. Or we'd ask Mike to make an intro in a few cases. What I had unknowingly created was a unit of conference commandos prepared in advance with information on who they were to meet, how we had done the research, and where. The results were astounding. The conference was packed. As a result, Deloitte saw an unprecedented amount of business come its way. We have since perfected this art at Ferrazzi Greenlight, and not only do we advise companies on how to get the most out of their conferences, but also big conference givers come to us to help them design conferences that will have world-class outcomes for both these companies and their conference attendees. The key is to work hard to make the conference a success for everyone. At the Hammer Conference, all attendees, almost across the board, were shocked by how much business they got done. The right environment was set for networking success. Of course, Michael Hammer was brilliant, as always, and there was much for all of us to learn from him on content. But everyone's success came from organizing a conference around its real function, an intimate gathering of like-minded professionals in an atmosphere that facilitates profitable relationships. Listen. Better yet, speak. Are you someone who thinks becoming a speaker is a big deal? That's true for a lot of people. I'm here to tell you it's not as tough as you might think, but it is also perhaps more important than you can imagine. Nothing frightens the daylights out of some people like the thought of spending 15 minutes talking about what they do in front of an audience, even if the audience is made up of generally receptive folks, like family and friends. Calm yourself. First, you should know that giving speeches is one of the easiest and most effective ways to get yourself, your business, and your ideas seen, heard of, and remembered. And you don't need to be Tony Robbins to find yourself a forum of people willing to hear you out. How many people find themselves in front of an audience on any given day? The numbers are shocking. There are thousands of forums and events going on for every imaginable reason, each and every day. All these forums need a warm body to say something the slightest bit inspiring or insightful to their guests. Most speakers, unfortunately, deliver neither. If you think the people delivering this insight are only those at the top of their respected fields, you're mistaken. So how do you get experience? Toastmasters International, for instance, provides a forum for the development of speaking skills. With more than 8,000 clubs meeting weekly in groups of up to 30 or 40 people, there are a whole lot of speeches and speakers being made. On a larger scale, the national speaker circuit is huge. The Convention Industry Council, CIC, says the meetings industry contributes over $100 billion annually to the GDP, with over $263 billion on direct spending. That ranks conferences ahead of the auto, air transportation, and movie industries in the GDP. The point here is that the opportunity to speak exists everywhere, paid or unpaid. It's fun, it can be profitable, and there's no better way to get yourself known and get to know others at an event. Study after study shows that the more speeches one gives, the higher one's income bracket tends to be. As a speaker at a conference, you have a special status, making meeting people much easier. They, in turn, give you respect that they don't accord their fellow attendees. Instant credibility and faux fame is bestowed upon you when you're on a stage, and pretty much any stage at that. How do you become a speaker at a conference? First, you need something to say. You need content, which I'll discuss in another chapter. You need to develop a spiel about the niche you occupy. In fact, you can develop a number of different spiels, catering to a number of different audiences. Again, I'll get to that later. If you take the first step and get to know the organizer, landing a speaking gig isn't that tough. In the beginning, it's best to start small. Let me give you an example. A friend of mine left his big firm years ago to start his own consulting business. He needed to establish himself as an expert in the field of branding, and while he was terrified of public speaking, he knew it would be the best way to interact with potential customers and hone his message. He started small, getting to know all the organizers of small, local, industry-specific events. He would ask these people, in return for his help, to give him a room during an off hour at the end of the event so that he could speak to a small gathering of people that he would organize. Initially, he wasn't even listed on the conference agenda. He'd meet people throughout the conference and tell them that he was organizing an intimate gathering of professionals interested in talking about their branding issues. The informal atmosphere allowed him to deliver his content without the pressure of a big audience, while at the same time getting valuable feedback from the people that attended. In short order, the rooms he spoke at started getting bigger, his speeches became more refined, and the audience went from intimate to intimidating, though by then he had worked through most of his fears. What if you're at a conference and you're not a speaker? There are other places to distinguish yourself. Remember, you're not there just to learn things from other people. You're there to meet others and have others meet and remember you. When sessions open up for questions, try and be among the first people to put your hand in the air. A really well-formed and insightful question is a mini opportunity to get seen by the entire audience. Be sure to introduce yourself. Tell people what company you work for, what you do, and then ask a question that leaves the audience buzzing. Ideally, the question should be related to your expertise, so you have something to say when someone comes up and says, "That was an interesting question." Connector's Hall of Fame Profile. Susan Cain. There's zero correlation between being the best talker and having the best ideas. Susan Cain is an avowed introvert who in 2012 stood before a crowd of thousands on the TED conference main stage and gave one of the most watched talks in the event's history. In it, she exhorted introverts to celebrate their unique gifts and to find ways to create impact in a world that favors extroverts. The talk was a favorite of Bill Gates and the erudite cultural critics at The New Yorker, among others. To prepare for the day, Cain kicked off what she called the Year of Speaking Dangerously. First, she joined Toastmasters, where she could practice speaking in front of others regularly among a low-risk, supportive crowd of strangers. She spent 2 hours with TED's speaking coach, who taught her how to lower the tone of her voice and breathe from her belly. She soon found herself practicing more publicly. When her book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, dropped, she was a guest on CBS This Morning, and in the hot seat for 21 radio interviews on the very first day of its launch. Finally, 1 week before TED,
Kane spent every day, all day, practicing with a second coach. They started on the couch and graduated to the stage, where he provided continuous feedback and a supportive ear. Using a prop provided further comfort and an elegant finale. She carried a suitcase with some of her favorite books with her to the stage. To close, she urged introverts to be brave enough to share what was in their own suitcases. Because the world needs you, and it needs the things you carry. Kane's speech urged introverts to celebrate traits that are not widely promoted by our yammering culture. Thoughtfulness, sensitivity, self-editing, heightened listening skills. But what made her talk most memorable was that, standing there on the stage, she embodied the very courage and vulnerability that she was urging others toward. For introverts and extroverts alike, that's the highest art of successful public speaking. To all you introverts, don't think of introversion as something that needs to be cured, as Kane wrote in Quiet. Her performance at TED highlights two of the best ways for you to make an impact while protecting your downtime: speaking publicly and attending conferences. These are high-impact, short-term opportunities that may exhaust you, but will also potentially reward you with as many new contacts as the extroverts are generating by being out 6 nights a week.
Guerrilla warfare. Organize a conference within a conference. True commandos are not restricted by the agenda that they receive at registration. Who says you can't arrange your own dinner while at the conference or put together an informal discussion on a particular topic that matters to you? The dinners at your average event are often a total mess. People's attention is scattershot. Everyone is trying to rise above the noise and be polite and engaged with 10 different strangers, listen to a keynote address, and get a few mouthfuls of mediocre food all at the same time. It doesn't make for a good setting for conversation. At times like these, I've been tempted to go back to my room, order room service, and spend the rest of the night in front of my laptop. That, however, would be a terrible lost opportunity. The alternative is to commandeer the useless hour or two by throwing a dinner of your own. I like to do this at least once during most conferences. Before the event, I'll scout out a nice nearby restaurant and send out pre-invites to a private dinner that I'll host alongside the scheduled affair. You can do this ad hoc during the day, or you can send out official invites beforehand. One way I've had big success is sending a fax to the hotel. Most conferences have one host hotel where most VIPs will be staying, that the individuals get when they arrive the night before the conference, asking them to join a group for dinner and drinks that night. Think about it. No secretaries to screen the message. Likely those people have no plans when they arrive, and even if they do, you will already stand out when you ultimately meet them during the conference, and I assure you, they will be grateful for your having thought of them. If the keynote address is being given by someone particularly interesting, I'll turn my own affair into pre- or post-dinner drinks. Often, creating your own forum is the best way to assure that people you're looking to meet will be in the same place at the same time. Ideally, you'd like to invite a stable of speakers to your dinner, which will provide a star-studded draw to your little event. Remember, even an unknown becomes a mini-star after his or her talk at an event. I did this many years at Renaissance Weekend, an annual New Year's weekend gathering for politicians, business people, and other professionals. I send out a funny invite, asking a few people if they'd like to play hooky from an official dinner and go to a nice restaurant elsewhere. At Renaissance Weekend, they even have a night designed for going off on your own to do just this. This works best at long 3-day conferences. As with college, everyone likes to get off campus. If the conference is in your hometown, be bold enough to invite people to your home for a real treat, as I have always done with the Los Angeles-based Milken Institute Global Conference. This conference is one of the best in the United States for both content and guests. Each year, I hold a dinner party at my house the day before the event is set to begin. People generally arrive in town a day early anyway, and a fun, intimate dinner party is always preferable to eating hotel food alone. Dinner is not the only way to organize a conference within a conference. Long conferences are often filled with social outings, golf tours, and visits to historic sites. Too often, such events are just plain terrible. Have you ever gone to a museum in a crowd of 400 people? You feel like a herded cow. There's no reason why you can't take the lead in developing your own personal tour or visit to an out-of-the-way place that convention organizers might not have thought about. An old colleague from Starwood used to do this at winter conferences. An avid skier, he'd research the best skiing in the area, usually some out-of-the-way slopes that no one had taken the time to discover. He'd have no problem attracting a few other skiers who were jazzed about the prospect of some fresh powder. The more active you become in playing host of your own conference within a conference, the better you'll be at helping other people make connections, making you a center of influence. When you meet people at your dinner party or event, don't simply introduce yourself. Introduce the folks you meet to other people. If your new acquaintances don't quickly take up the conversation, offer a fact about one guest to another. Sergio was in charge of Coke's global branding efforts in their heyday. Aren't you looking to refurbish your company's brand, David? You couldn't find a better sounding board than Sergio. Draft off a big kahuna. If you get to know the most popular man or woman at the conference, the one who knows everyone, you'll be able to hang with them as they circle through the most important people at the conference. Conference organizers, speakers, and name brand CEOs and professionals attending the event are all worthy kahunas. Check the conference program for the names of luminaries and key figures. Make those the sessions you attend. Arrive early at the events where they'll be speaking. Stand near key entrances or registration tables. Be ready to introduce yourself, or stay behind for a quick chance to meet them. You must remember to talk with speakers before they've hit the stage. Often that anonymous schlub slurping yogurt at the breakfast table will take on the aura of a celebrity after he's spoken on stage. Find them before they've gained celebrity status, and you have a better chance to connect. Or ask the conference organizer, who has become your buddy anyway, to point them out if you don't know what they look like. Be an information hub. Once you've created an opportunity to meet new people, establish yourself as an information hub, a key role of any good networker. How? Go beyond just memorizing the conference's brochure. Identify information the people around you would like to know, and come prepared. This might include information about trade gossip, the best local restaurants, private parties, etc. Pass key information along, or let others know how they can obtain it. This role does not end with the networking event, of course. As an information resource, You're someone always worth knowing.
Become a reporter. These days, every conference has an omnipresent peanut gallery, the ongoing conversations through Twitter and other social media. Before the conference, identity